friend of mine called Jono in Sheffield, who started one small group. Basically, God was all over him. He was anointed. And at its height, they had over 50 small groups in Sheffield. And for a three-year period, they saw a student a week become a Christian.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Profile with me, Megan Cornwell. This is the show where we delve into a person's life, faith and ministry. Today I'm speaking with Rich Wilson. Rich heads up the student mission movement Fusion, which helps students respond to the call of God and equips churches to support students. Rich has recently published his first book, A Call Less Ordinary, which delves into the theme of recognising God's calling in our lives. Rich, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Megan. Great to be with you.
So at this time of recording, we're both in full lockdown mode due to the pandemic. Rich, Can you just tell us a bit about how life's changed for you?
It's got local. Used to travelling a little bit around the country. Both myself and my wife are in leadership. My wife leads a church and a network of churches called Pioneer. As you said, I'm involved in Fusion. We've got two daughters. One is about to turn 17. One has just turned 12. And we're spending a lot more time together. And I think on the whole, we're doing quite well. Giving each other space when we need it and going on a few dog walks most days. And I think initially we were in the blizzard. We were just adjusting. We were firefighting. We were pivoting. We were doing all the different things that we were trying to do. And now I think we've settled into some good rhythms. And I wouldn't say we're enjoying it. I think we're probably more tolerating it. It's not our preference for leadership. We like being around people, but at the same time, recognizing there's lots to be learned in this season and trying to learn the lessons of things that we might not learn otherwise.
Yeah, seeing it as glass half full.
Yes, I think so, yeah.
And what about your work with students? How has that been impacted?
Well, We felt early on as lockdown was approaching, I felt God speak to us quite clearly about, three things really. One was what we sow in this season really matters. The other was there's ground to be taken or lost, lots of it, not just a little bit. And the other was, what does it mean to seek first the kingdom? Probably more so than self-protection. As we thought about those things, we just felt God was saying to us that student mission isn't on hold. He still wants to reach students. That's why we exist. He's not lifting the mandate offers, not even for a few weeks of lockdown. And so we basically moved all our training online. Everything went online. It was kind of quite heady the first 3 weeks. So we ended up doing about 110 training sessions for small groups online initially. And then we've been kind of working out other bits of strategy for how do we support students? How do we encourage them? How do we speak hope to them? That's been a massive area that I felt very, very strongly. It's been very disorientating and very disappointing for lots of students. So when we talk about calling, one of the things we'd be saying was, your circumstances have changed, but your calling hasn't. So how do we push into God at this time? And we've been encouraged as well by lots of student responses. We've found that they've been getting bolder in sharing their faith online. Lots of My Good News hashtags. And small groups have grown and some have multiplied. And we've heard of students becoming Christians. So it's been a whole mix. But basically, we've kept the whole team on, 24. And they've been pretty busy with training and connecting and supporting people in the student world and life stage.
Great. And what would you say have been your sort of highs and lows of lockdown?
The lows for me personally have just not been being around some friends face to face. I really miss eating and drinking together with others. You know, we're used to lots of hospitality, lots of hanging out, and that's a human trait that goes back to the beginning that you just can't shake off. So I've really missed that. The highs, I think, are I do sense that God's at work. And whilst it's been hugely disruptive, there's been areas for grieving and lament. But at the same time, I kind of feel like the nation needs to shake a little bit if it's to genuinely turn to God. And I sense there's an awakening going on. So I guess alongside all the disruption and the pain and the chaos, I see that God is with us. He's present, and he's wanting to outwork our purposes in our lives and in our nation. And that's actually filled me with lots of hope.
Mm. Yeah. Well, talking about hope, can we go back to your story, sort of early years, and look at how you became a Christian and talk a little bit about your journey to faith?
Yes. Yeah. So I was brought up in a home where my mum was a Christian, although she had an encounter when I was two that basically was a Holy Spirit encounter where I think she got serious in her faith. And my dad was agnostic all the way through to my teenage years, probably my mid-teens, and then he became a Christian then. And I for whatever reason, had a belief in God. So I think I was always God-fearing. I was always aware of God. I'd pray. Maybe I'd pray quite superstitiously as a child, alleviating fears. But there was a sense that God was present. He was real. And I went to church, albeit reluctantly at times. I just didn't really get church. I'm much more thankful for my church experience as a child now than I was then. I was kicking against it then. But one of the turning points, there's probably a few turning points, but probably one of the main ones was as a 17-year-old going on a youth weekend away. I lived in near Manchester, and the youth weekend away was in Norfolk, and it was a 400-mile round trip. And I thought then, why are we going so far for a weekend? This just seems a bit ridiculous. Why can't we go somewhere closer? But I think with God's economy, it isn't to do with how far we travel or where we end up. It's often to do with the people. And the people we met there were a Pentecostal couple who were farmers. So we ended up staying on this farm with Pentecostal farmers. And he was an extraordinary man, a guy called Tony, and he was full of the Holy Spirit. And really, he was the first person I came across who really explained it to me in a way that I understood. And at the end of this weekend, I went to see him in his lounge. And I can't remember what we talked about, but I remember him praying for me. And I had a profound encounter that I would call an ignition moment in my life, where the Holy Spirit kind of impacted me and overwhelmed me, and I just began to sob and went back to normal life after that, but noticed some changes in me. My hunger for God was greater. My appetite for adventure was beginning to grow, and I felt that was connected. And then I went to university, and that was a great time to explore faith away from home, away from upbringing, and away from maybe people's frozen perceptions of me, and threw myself into what God was doing at uni with a group of friends.
You did sort of sense this growing call to student ministry while you were at university in Loughborough. Can you tell us a bit about how that came about?
Yeah, so at university, I connected with a group of people who had experienced basically a mini move of God in their hall of residence. And they were probably the most dynamic group of Christians I'd ever come across. And I was really attracted to them. And they really opened up church. I began to fall in love with church in a way that I never had, because I realized it was people and it was community and it was people on a mission. And I found myself caught up in that. And they stayed around to plant this church called Open Heaven. And I thought, I want to be part of that. I want to join in with that. And as I joined in, and I think as I served them, I discovered that their passion for students, that, and I was a student at the time, was growing in me. And it began to develop. And it was actually the year after I graduated when I said, you know, I want to stay around and serve this church and be part of it, that I had a moment where I thought, this feels a bit deeper than just a year out. It feels like, God, you're saying to me things about my generation. And I had some fairly heady daydreams at that time about, God, what does it mean to disciple my generation? What does it mean to see a move of God in my generation? And I think probably God began to break my heart for my generation and for students. And it was a student part that stuck. And there was nothing dramatic at that moment, but there was just a growing and deepening sense that I had a part to play in a bigger student movement. And I had no idea what that was, but was just getting on with it locally. We started a couple of student small groups, and that was the expression, that was the entirety of it at the time.
Well, we'll come on to talk a bit more about that in detail later on. But it struck me as interesting that in your book, you talk about Simon Gilbo being part of that cohort.
Yes.
He's been interviewed on this show, and he obviously went on to do some quite extraordinary things in Burundi. Do you feel that there was some sort of powerful move of God then amongst those people at that time?
I think it was an interesting group of people who were fired up for God, and they fired up each other and they spurred on each other. And they were, on one level, they were all quite different, but what we had in common was this passion for Jesus and this passion for mission. And I don't know if we recognized it at the time, but it is interesting to see where people have gone since and stay in contact with a few people. And Simon is one of the people I'm still in close contact with. And our time at university was very, very formative. And I think it was for a number of people in that group who've gone on to lead churches and lead in other parts of society. Time will tell. This is the fun thing with student mission, is we plant seeds in student lives and we don't really know what happens, and one day we'll find out. But that's the faithful piece, I think, is just doing what's in front of us and trusting that God joins dots that maybe we don't even know exist. But sometimes we get to get a look in for some things, and journeying with Simon's been a great pleasure.
And you've been working for Fusion for 25 years, Rich. Tell us a bit about how the movement started.
It's just under 25 years. It started with a group of people from across different churches, denominations, networks, having a growing sense that more was needed because the student mission field was growing. It wasn't that there wasn't good work going on, but student numbers had increased 700%. But there wasn't a corresponding increase in mission. And one thing that was certainly missing was local church involvement. So there was a sense from churches and church leaders that maybe there's room and space for some other models of mission in the university. And so we started with a small group model across, you know, Fusion really was a fusion of church unity and different groups of people coming together who formed some of the core leadership team. And it was an idea that was untested. And I guess I was involved in testing the idea of, will this work? So it was in 1998 that I started working with Fusion full time. I was in contact with them during their launch year in 97, 98. And we really wanted to take this idea of small groups and the power of small groups and students on a mission together. What could happen if they got fired up? And lots of precedent from history. So drawing a lot on some of the Wesleyan awakening and how he put people in small groups and how important that was to people's discipleship and for movement in the nation and change in the nation. And that was some of the inspiration. So it was kind of heady days. We didn't really know what we were doing. All we knew was that we've got some core ingredients of faith and a bit of fire and some enthusiasm and a structure for doing small groups that students could easily adopt and take on. And my role really was just to go around and to champion that and to do lots of training. So I probably spent the first 8 years just training small groups and traveling wherever there was interest. And sometimes there wasn't much interest. But over the first few years, things did seem to happen. That was quite an extraordinary time looking back.
Can you share some of the stories of some of the sort of powerful things that happened and the impact that those small groups had in their universities and amongst their communities?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's only in writing the book that I got to reflect more deeply. And at the time, I wasn't really aware of what was going on. I was just going with it. But looking back, I think there was something of a bit of a move of the spirits across the universities in these small groups. Some of the multiplication of them was extraordinary. So I write about a friend of mine called Jono in Sheffield who started one small group and ended up being on the fusion team and working alongside me because basically God was all over him. He was anointed. And at its height, they had over 50 small groups in Sheffield. And for a 3-year period, they saw a student a week become a Christian. I mean, it was quite remarkable. And then in other places, I mean, in St. Andrews, Olu, a Nigerian student, started a small group with the backing of a church leader. It multiplied, but then the following year, it multiplied into 9 small groups. And they ended up planting a church called Revolution that would meet in the back of a pub. And it was student-led, supported by this local church. And really what we noticed was things was bubbling all over the country. There was a real energy about it. Liverpool was another hot spot where things were multiplying fast. And where we found it was often working best was where local leaders were saying to students, you know what, we've got your back here. We want to support you. And that probably led to some of the future change and transition. Oxford was another one. I remember very clearly going to Oxford and talking to some of the leaders and the students of a particular church. And we shared the vision with great enthusiasm, and then the meeting kind of fell a little bit flat, and the students kind of were saying, oh, but this is Oxford, nothing really changes here, we can't really imagine that happening. And then there was this strange power cut in the building, and that changed the atmosphere, but it also changed the spiritual atmosphere. And these same students then began to pray and to speak out and to prophesy from the Psalms and Isaiah about things changing and ancient gates opening up and things happening. And again, there was a real movement of the Spirit in Oxford. And I think it was broader than just us, but we were noticing it with some of the churches we were working with. And in contacting some of the leaders at the time, particularly a guy called Duncan Popery in Newcastle, I remember doing some training with them really early on, maybe 1999. And it was about 15 years later, he said, you know, out of those 12 people who were involved in that small group, that initial small group up there, 11 of them are now in full-time church leadership. Mm-hmm. So we really didn't know what we were doing. We were just doing what was in front of us. We were, I guess, being obedient and taking the opportunities that were there, not really knowing what seeds were being sown, but God was calling people and igniting people. And I think that was the other encouraging thing looking back was it was a seedbed for people's callings and passions to be ignited. And lots of people have gone on into all kinds of areas of society from those small groups. And most people, I've got no idea where they are, but I get to hear the odd story every now and again. And I think that's the potential of the church, isn't it? It's not just us, it's what happens. But particularly with students, if they can get hold of what God has for them, or at least decide, you know what, the best thing for me is to orientate my entire life around God's purposes. That is the way to a fulfilling and fruitful life. And often it starts at university. Often it starts in young adulthood when there's a bit more freedom to make decisions and to live with the consequences of those. But to really make those decisions for themselves.
Yeah. And Rich, you're passionate about linking up these student groups with the local church. And you and your wife are leaders at Open Heaven.
Yes.
which is a student-led church, as I understand it.
It started that way. So when we were leading it in our 20s and just married, we were the only married people in the church for a season. The other married couple we sent off to Africa, and that meant we were the only married couple, and we were about 100. It was 98% single and one married couple, and the demographic was 18 to 28. That was how we were for a while. Since then, we have evolved, we've grown. We've now got three expressions. We've got an all-age expression, we've got an international expression, and we've still got what we call an 18 to 30s expression that anyone's welcome at, but the target is more towards students and recent graduates. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we've grown up as time's gone on, but we've maintained our student focus. We're passionate still about the university and about students.
And what about this sort of the 3-year turnaround, you know, with students being at university, well, generally 3 to 4 years. Do you find that sort of you lose momentum when that cohort then moves on? How do you ensure that those kinds of skills and the training that you've invested in is then passed down to the next generation of Christians entering the Christian Union?
Yeah, well, it's it is a bit like Groundhog Day each year. You know, every September, October, there's an opportunity for Christian students to find churches, and there's an opportunity to also welcome all students to the city and the town. And I think that's where we want to move the agenda in the UK, is that we've got this huge mission field. Yes, we want Christian students to connect, but also there's this huge mission field that churches need to engage in more broadly. I think... Because there's a sense of calling, because we've tapped into something of God's mission to students, there's an energy and a grace to keep going. And so we've had student workers in place probably for the last 15 or 16 years. And we've kept working with them. And often they'll be in post for 3 to 4 years. And so there's some knowledge that keeps recycling from student worker to student worker and generation to generation. But each year group that comes in almost needs special attention and grounding and readiness. And similarly, when they graduate, we make a really big deal of their graduation. And this year is a tough one because they're graduating without the fanfare at university. And we're working out how do we make a big deal as churches who've journeyed with the students, but they're not around to celebrate. But in previous years, we've done a lot in terms of the prep for graduation. And almost a commissioning. So some students may stay in the area and stay as part of church, but often the majority will go, and we want to send them. You know, they don't belong to us. They belong to Jesus. They're part of his kingdom plans. And so the best thing that we can do as a local church is commission them, pray for them, prophesy over them, and speak real hope into them for their future. And that includes this year's year of graduates who, for many, I think they're thinking, well, what opportunities are there? But like we mentioned before, the circumstances have changed radically. But I believe the call of God in their lives hasn't changed. And if they can find a way of pushing into God and allowing him to reframe maybe their disappointment, like Jesus did on the road to Emmaus, he reframed the disappointment of those disciples and they came away warmed and with hope. That's what I kind of feel we need to do with this year's graduates.
And turning now to talk about your book, Rich, can you just describe a bit about what motivated you to write A Call Less Ordinary?
I think probably it's been 25 years of working with students and seeing the potential in them and seeing the call of God on their lives. And at the same time, calling being something that is emotive and a little bit mysterious for lots of young adults and actually older adults. What's my calling is a question that gets asked fairly regularly in the Christian world. And so wanted to try and through story and through my own experience, share some ups and downs that I felt I'd learned. And I remember sitting at my desk probably 4.5 years ago now, thinking, I've learned some fairly big life lessons, and if I don't write them down, I'm never going to share them effectively. And And I felt at that point that God mandated me to begin to write. And I didn't write with a view of actually publishing a book. I just wrote because I felt I needed to get some things out and put them on paper. And it ended up, obviously, as a Call Less Ordinary. But it was really to give particularly students and young adults a frame of reference for the journey of calling, that it doesn't happen all at once. Sometimes it's confusing, but there are some pathways that God has for us, and there's some principles that we lay hold of that means that we can have a fulfilling and a fruitful life. And even the difficult points in our life that will surely come, God will use those as well. Mm-hmm. So in some way, wanting to prepare them for the life of calling, for the 40 years of work and ministry that lies ahead, and give them a few maybe tools and ideas for how they might process some of the bumps in the road, maybe the little bumps and the big bumps that are different from each of us, but there's maybe some common principles to apply.
Premier Christianity Magazine.
Are you fed up with fake news or bored of bad stories? We think it's time for something different. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. Every month, our team publishes stories of lives transformed, testimonies, miracles, healings, and loads more good news. We're here to encourage you, excite you, and keep you up to date with all that God is doing through His church. That's why we're proud to bring you a magazine that's different.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
And you talk in the book about these ignition moments. Can you just describe what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think not everybody has them in no one has them in exactly the same way. But often there are times in our Christian walk where we find ourselves encountering God in a unique way. Sometimes that's accompanied with feelings, you know. So John Wesley has this phrase when he was at Aldersgate, he was strangely warmed, you know, and the disciples on the road to Emmaus, didn't our hearts burn within us? I found myself sobbing, but I just knew it wasn't just my tears. It was God on me and through me. It was more than just my emotion coming out. And I guess it's moments where we feel that we are maybe closer to God than we've known before, or maybe we have known it before, but it's just not that often. They're quite rare, but they're not as rare as we might imagine. And maybe most of us can point to at least one moment where we've had some sort of encounter, and it might be we're on our own, or it might be in a church gathering or a conference or something. But it's where we felt something of God noticing us and impressing something on us, that He's noticed us. And probably, if we're to reflect on it, probably something of His calling on our lives, even though we might not be able to articulate the specifics of that. We just know that we belong to Jesus, and we know that we belong to Him, and He's got us. And we can't manufacture those things, but we can be open to them. We can be open to God meeting us. And actually, deep down, I think that's what lots of us crave, not just as a one-off, but we crave an intimacy with God. But sometimes he just does that a little bit more, and it shapes us and it defines us. So that was true for me, and I know it's true for lots of people, but I also know that others maybe haven't had that, and it's been more of a slow burn.
Yeah, I was struck in your book when you talked about a particularly difficult time, and we'll come on to that in a minute, but your response to it was to sort of swear at God, which I thought was really interesting. But you sort of felt completely comfortable with that, because you sort of describe it as being known by God, and God knew what you were going through. And I guess it struck me that you are somebody that has an intimacy with God, and that's important to you, and a friendship with God. And I think a lot of people struggle with seeing God as a judging God or as a harsh God. How have you developed that intimacy with God over the years?
Slowly. I think our life experience shapes us, our parenting shapes us, our own decisions shape us, the wise ones, the foolish ones. But God is so committed to us. And if we dare to participate with him, I think we find ourselves getting drawn into, I think, a place of fullness that maybe I wouldn't have imagined. So I talk quite candidly about some of the ups and downs in the book. But I have to say now, I feel much more at peace with myself than I've ever felt. I feel more joyful, not that life is always full of, it's not removed from hard things. There's some really tough things going on in life right now. But at the same time, I think because there's been a depth of relationship cultivated, and it's been up and down, it's been on and off. I'm not brilliant at discipline. I'm not brilliant at sometimes making those important small choices. But I think I've made enough of them over my life that I'm living in the benefit of it. Mm-hmm. And that's my encouragement. And my encouragement is, if at first it doesn't seem to be working, persevere. God is noble, and he's more interested in us and the detail of our lives than we realize. Mm-hmm. And he's much more interested in things that maybe aren't recognized or celebrated in culture. We sometimes think to be successful as a Christian, we need to be known and recognized and have obvious fruits. But I don't think God's metrics are the same. He's really interested in just how we tick, and he delights in us, in our idiosyncrasies, in our, you know, in our quirkiness, in who we are. And I think that's a bit of a revelation that needs to happen in our hearts and our heads. But and it's unfolding. You know, we never arrive. I've not arrived by any means. I am absolutely on the journey. And I think in that sense, the work with students is mirrored in our own lives, that we remain students our whole lives. He is the teacher. We are the students. And we're called to be lifelong learners. But I wanted to share my experience to give, again, people hope that this is lived experience, and it works. I've taken the words of Jesus. I've taken the words of Scripture. I've applied them. I've found them to be true. And I'm just one of millions of testimonies. You know, we've all got those stories. But I think particularly for the generation coming through, and maybe for non-Christians as well, who are curious and reading things, that these stories add up. And that's the power of our lives, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, I was really struck and impressed by some of the stories that you shared in your book, Rich, particularly the very, very painful ones around the death of your son, your newborn son, and the health problems that your daughter went through.
Yeah.
And I thought as I was reading through, I actually felt very moved by them. But I thought, gosh, this was very brave to do. You know, you could have easily left these sections out of a book around calling. You didn't necessarily have to leave those parts in. Can you just share a bit about why you felt they were important to include in the book?
Yes, Megan. I'm quite a private person, so this didn't come naturally to me to want to put myself out there. And so consequently, the book was written over 3.5 years. It was written prayerfully and carefully, and I wanted to make sure that what was written was things that I was happy with being out there. And I do think God helped me in this. So, you know, one of the things I felt God speak to me was about pouring my life out as an offering, because that's what he did for us. So I didn't feel I had any right to hold anything back, particularly holding back stuff where I might have some things that would be helpful to others, that others could take comfort in or learn from. And whilst the specifics of that journey of Josiah and his death and other things that happen are unique to me and very unlikely to happen to many people, I think the common things of we all have things to grieve in our lives. And we all have things that come our way that we didn't choose, that we have to deal with. So how are we going to navigate those? And where is God when life takes a turn in the road that you never wanted and you didn't see coming? And I don't claim to have the answers, as you know, if you've read the chapters, I don't have the answers. But in terms of pushing into God, that is part of the answer. And
I think that really came, across in the book. You know, it was amazing to see the way that you learned so much more about God through those very, very painful times. Do you want to share a bit more about what you learned about the nature of God through those moments?
It's things that I'm still learning as well, but I think it was that in the deepest moments of pain and grief and moments in life that I couldn't really have imagined going through, in reaching out to God, I found that he was present. So amongst a million questions of why, the answers were not ever going to be articulated in a way that I could write down in a book, but somehow I found some answers in his presence. So the Bible talks about how God draws close to the brokenhearted, and that's just good news for all of us, because there's times when we're all feeling more broken in life than at other times, and maybe this is one of those times with what's happening at different levels in our culture and society. And the good news is he comes close. And if we dare to kind of enter into that space, Parker Palmer calls them winters, where if we dare to enter into them, we will find that God will meet us there. And I think that was the encouragement, that to try and go a different route, to try and resist the pain was not going to work. So, I'm not an expert on grief, but I felt with the help of friends and the help of reading books and the help of the Holy Spirit, that grief was a journey to be fully embraced in order to walk through it. And in doing that, maybe encountering some things in God that I couldn't have imagined. So Isaiah talks about there being treasure in the darkness. And I certainly found that. I certainly found that in inviting God into the hardest and darkest places, that there was treasure there, that there was his presence there, that there was learning there, and there was probably the beginning of healing there. And it's a funny thing to have both pain and presence screaming at the same time, but that was what was going on. And I think that's why there's hope. So for whatever situation we find ourselves in, and suffering is a sliding scale for people, we all suffer in different ways, but God wants to come into our suffering, whatever that might be. And if we dare to invite him, we might not feel anything in the moment, but over time, with kind of repeated turn to God, I think it changes us, it transforms us. Mm-hmm. And I think for me and for anyone really, I think it's probably the one of the number one discipleship questions is, what do we do with our pain? Because I think our pain, depending on how we deal with it, can either make us better or it can make us bitter. You know, if we bury it or don't face it, that's a much bigger problem for us. So the encouragement, even though it's more painful or it feels more painful at the time to face it, it's the healthy thing to do. Mm-hmm. And it's also transforming in a positive way. Mm-hmm.
You had a quite profound experience with God, didn't you, sometime after the very sad and tragic death of your son, a very unusual spiritual experience involving him as an older man.
Yes.
Can you just describe that? What happened?
Yeah, so this was a huge surprise to me. It was an unwanted trip down to Leicester. So I'm based in Loughborough, and I had to travel to Leicester to register his birth and his death at the same time. And on the journey, as I was going down the Soar Valley, I don't remember much of the journey, because I kind of had this vision of him in heaven, not as a baby anymore, but as a young man, really radiant, really healthy, really strong. Stuff maybe that I kind of discerned was in his spirit when I was in the hospital, thinking there's more to you. And then I was seeing it in a physical form. And it surprised me and delighted me and made me bawl my eyes out. And it was just a very, very profound experience. And I just think it was part of the kindness of God in the whole thing, that he was letting me have a little glimpse. And it's there in scripture, you know, the hope of resurrection. That's the Christian hope. The Christian hope isn't about just we get to live a slightly better life here on earth, you know, and whatever, whatever. It's a genuine hope that one day God will set everything right. You know, there's a justice in God. We're never going to see this side of heaven. There's a healing in God. We're never going to see this side of heaven, but he's got that in store for us. And it's what the early church preached most about. You know, it's the gospel of the kingdom has this resurrection peace. And we don't talk about it a great deal in our churches, even though Tom Wright has written Surprised by Hope. And I think it's becoming more, mainstream, if I can say that. We celebrate it every Easter, but it's actually part of the gospel all year round. And then there's a book called Imagine Heaven that I only read a few months ago, and I'm quite pleased I only read that book after writing my book, because there were stories in that book that were very similar to my experience, and I was kind of pleased I wasn't influenced by those. And then I had a letter from someone the other day who'd read my book and said, I actually had the same experience. Mm-hmm. So whilst they're not common, I think it's God's kindness giving us a glimpse that there's more, and we still have to go through the grieving and we still have to go through the pain. But there is this hope, this mm-hmm. hope of resurrection, this hope of heaven. And then I got this remarkable letter as well.
Oh yeah, the prophetic letter. That was very, very, I was really shocked when I read about that.
Yeah, and I was shocked when I received it. And that was 6 months later on, where a very prophetic lady handed me the most remarkable letter of a dream she'd had, where she described meeting my son Josiah as a man in heaven. And
so it just really confirmed to you.
Yes, it was confirming, it was affirming, it was deeply humbling. And it was another thing of, God, you know me, you know, you know me, you see me, you see my heart, you see the end from the beginning. Remarkable. Mm. Remarkable.
And did having that sort of glimpse of what heaven could be like, has that changed your perspective towards your ministry and your work here on earth?
I think it has. I think, again, it's not instant. I think it's a slow burn for both Ness and I, actually. Ness is probably further along than I am in terms of her understanding of heaven and her longing for heaven, whilst at the same time being fully involved in what we're doing today in the present. It's a growing thing. And I think maybe, and I'm hoping it will grow even more as I get older. You know, none of us know how long we've got, but I'm hoping I've got a bit longer. But I'm also hoping that revelation and that expectancy of heaven will grow as I grow older. Mm-hmm. As a genuine hope. And we do reflect, there's nothing we trade. I think that it's big enough to know there's nothing we trade in this life right now for Jesus just putting everything right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an unfolding, deepening sense of God's goodness and what he's got for us.
And just to go back again to your work around calling and your own work with Fusion, Rich, you've been there for nearly 25 years. How do you sort of stay motivated in the sort of same calling day in, day out? What would you do to others in a similar situation?
I'm not motivated every day. I think as someone who gets bored quite easily, I'm a little bit staggered by the fact that I'm still here. But I had a moment in my 20s where I did feel like God was asking me to give 4 decades to this work. Now, I've not held that over me, and that might not still be true, but I'm 2.5 decades in. And I just think there's a grace for it. I think that's the thing with life. Often I see people doing remarkable things in all kinds of walks of life, and I think, how can you do that? How are you motivated to do that? How do you keep going in that? And I think probably they've got a grace for it because it's something of what they're wired for and what they're called for. And I can only describe that as being true for me. And the challenge is to keep investing, to keep making good decisions, small decisions, daily decisions. I don't want to, I think as I'm now in my mid-40s, there's definitely a temptation maybe to take my foot off the gas, to kind of cruise, to live off the experience gained. But I'm also really aware that what I sow now and what I sow in this decade, I'll reap in the next decade. And I want to keep being the learner, the student, and I want to be more fruitful. I want life to be more fruitful in God, whether that's measurable on the outside to other people or not. So that's the motivation. And I think the other one is just for work in general. I've just always had a sense that my primary employer is Jesus and that he's watching. And it doesn't mean I do everything right. It doesn't mean I'm always disciplined. But on the whole, I live with a sense that I'm accountable to him for what I do with my time and my work. And we don't always, you know, it's funny, we don't always feel like we are the right people for the job. Sometimes we have the imposter syndrome. I think that happens to leaders much more than they admit. But ultimately, I've not got a plan B or an exit strategy until, you know, God reveals it. So I think that's it. And the big thing I put in the book as well is, try not to compare. You know, God's got a race for each of us to run. And it's really important we run our race. And we run it with others and we cheer other people on. But we aren't looking and thinking, oh, you know, I need to be doing that like that leader or doing that like that leader. We can be inspired by them, but the comparison thing, I'm hoping that's disappearing more in the church as we're learning how to be one body, working together for God's kingdom. But it doesn't mean there isn't a, you know, a few inattentions, and social media highlights that hugely. So we've got to work hard at that.
You talked earlier about some of the moves of the spirit that you've seen in the past at certain universities. Are you seeing currently in 2020 any particular universities that are sort of, there's something exciting happening?
I wouldn't say there's anything dramatic. You know, I love the revival history of the Hebrides and other things where there's dramatic moves of God, and I'd love that to happen. But it's not going to stop us keeping going. What I think I'm seeing is a rising sea level of faith and interest and confidence in the gospel. That was a big question a few years ago. Where's the confidence in the gospel? Well, I'm seeing it increase. So I think there's signs there, even if there's not a kind of a giddiness with lots of people becoming Christians in gatherings night after night or week after week. But there does seem to be a steady stream of salvation in the universities and the churches we're working with. So that no one can really take credit, because it's not, there's not a hotspot at the moment that might emerge. But it does seem like God is readying the church and readying the student generation for more. And I'm certainly very, very expectant going into this next academic year with all the uncertainty that actually we will advance, that student mission will move forward, that a lot more of this generation will turn to faith. And it would be nice to have some hotspots that we can be inspired by. But there are lots of stories coming through of students finding faith. So I'm expecting the tide to rise further.
And what about opposition to the gospel, Rich, on campuses? You know, every now and again we hear stories about Christian unions not being allowed to be at the Freshers' Fair and things like that. Can you explain a bit about what's going on that front?
So I think that universities are secular institutions, so they don't necessarily owe us anything. And I think where there's been religious fundamentalism and things with recent world events, that there's been a nervousness about all religion on campus. And then there's also been a liberal agenda that actually it's just not needed. I'm thinking maybe that's diminishing again. I think there's more subtle opposition than just silencing. I think that, you know, there has been a free speech issue, and it's not just been Christians who've been at the sharp end of that. Actually, lots of people have been banned from platforms, and most of the people I've heard have been banned from platforms have not been Christians. So it's not a persecution thing just for Christians. So I think there is barriers and obstacles to overcome, but I think the way we live and what we model and how we love our neighbour is going to speak volumes. And there may well be some new opposition coming through over the coming months and years. And I think we can expect that if we see the Spirit begin to move a little bit more. But some of the biggest barriers, I think, have just been the cultural ones, the distraction, the competing for bandwidth with entertainment and busyness and Netflix and social media. I think they are much, much more challenging than maybe a few people saying, oh, you can't say this here or there. Mm.
Yeah. Do you have a message for the graduates this year who are maybe coming out into the world for the first time and thinking even more so than perhaps previous years, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? You know, we're in the middle of a pandemic, the economy's probably going to tank. What on earth am I going to do?
Yes, I do. I'm not sure how well I can articulate it here, because I've been praying over this in recent weeks. I've written a letter to the class of 2020 because I felt God wanted to encourage the this year's graduates. So that's on the Fusion site, and it's on a few other sites. But basically, it is one of hope. You know, there might not be the immediate opportunities, but God has plans for you and they are good. And there's things to be learnt through challenge and through difficulty and through this next season that will be important for what your future holds and for what God has for you. So I think it is a case of speaking hope and encouragement to this year's graduates and saying, do something, you know, even if you can't find the job you want, or maybe indeed any job, find someone to serve. Do something. Get up each time. Start your day by opening the Bible. Commit your ways to God. Open your hands and say, God, establish the work of my hands. I don't know what to do with my hands today or this year, but God, establish the work of my hands. And pray it consistently. I went through that phase for about a year and a half before starting with Fusion. And every now and again, I still pray. I still get stuck in the role I'm in. And I pray this prayer, God, establish the work of my hands. And he will do that. He can be trusted with our future. He has good things for us. But he might not take us on the most direct route or the route we'd hoped we were going to take. But that route will be full of things that will be helpful and useful for us. And so I'm actually quite excited by what will get formed as this generation grab hold of God and choose him at this time. Mm-hmm. I'm quite excited by what they're going to do, even though it's not obvious or maybe apparent at the moment. But I think the history books will tell us that those who are graduating at this time and maybe starting university at this time, I believe God is going to be charging them with some unique kingdom tasks and missions. Mm. And as an older leader, I want to just encourage them.
And finally, are you seeing students embracing some of the technologies that we've been embracing during this pandemic, in order to do things a bit differently? So are you seeing any kind of interesting ways that students are reaching out and evangelizing despite the fact that they're restricted in their movements and restricted by lockdown?
Yes, I mean it's second nature to lots of them as to how to use it. But what I have noticed is the increase in boldness and how they you know, there was a group of students who were connected with the church here, and they had a hashtag, My Good News. And they were basically putting a 2 minute, it might have been a song, a poem, a short film, basically just sharing My Good News, why Jesus is good news to them. really innovative, really bold, and getting lots of curiosity and interest, you know, whilst some of them had to swallow quite hard and go, this feels like a bit of a stretch, putting myself out there. I think all of them would say they had so much positive feedback and some great questions from friends who weren't Christians but were interested. And then others have been running small groups online, inviting their friends into that, running Alpha online. And so there has been a whole load of activity, and they, you know, lots of them have been making the most of it, and we've been encouraging them to do that. And long may it continue.
Amen. Well, Rich, it's been a real pleasure speaking to you today. Thanks ever so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Megan. Really good to chat with you as well.
I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. But join us next week at the same time to hear more stories and wisdom from Christian leaders around the world.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together, because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 27th through July 7th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.